About the last lecture, there was this rules for the lambda terms. So there was the introduction and elimination, as I said. So we had something like P and X. The introduction for lambda just had one premise. And then we could derive I don't remember, I probably call it at lambda intro A to B. So this intuition about introduction elimination, it refers to types and not to terms. So we have pair introduction because we have products. Here we have lambda introduction because we have an arrow in a type. So if we change the type, then accordingly we have the corresponding rules for introduction elimination of terms. So that could be called lambda introduction. And this P say F from A to B. So this produces F of P of type B. This can be called lambda elimination or arrow elimination. So in the Gloin course, we had this elimination introduction rules referring to the connectivities, and the connectivities are here on the level of type. So we have this arrow, we could just have this arrow elimination rule or arrow introduction rule. Okay, and we are introduced terms in context, and so this context is a technical tool which we're going to use, but we don't need it all the time, so we can talk about terms. And we say that we also use them freely. If we just don't need the context, and then we can use the term, and just using this means that the construction T in some context is derivable for some gamma and for some return type. So after all these preliminaries about operational semantics, I guess it's not difficult for you would be to give an operational semantics for this calculus, for this PCF language, which I introduced last. But there are a couple of subtleties. So perhaps I give some rules and not all. And first, I consider S called by name. Operational semantics. So, for example, if I want to tell what the semantics of a pair is, what I do, I evaluate P, say to C1, and evaluate Q, say to C2, and then P, the pair P and Q evaluates to C1 and C2. And this is a case where laziness doesn't help me, because if I need to know what the result of a pair is, I need to evaluate both components of the pair. And this contrasts the case with the projection. So if I want to calculate PR1 of P, say, well, actually, in this case, it doesn't help too. So I evaluate P to a pair C and D, and then the projection evaluates to C. So I must have specified these things, of course, on the right hand side. A value is a Boolean or a natural or just this unit element or a pair of or a pair of values. So this is the definition of the things I evaluate to. So I need to make sure that all the rules that I'm giving, they are producing values. So this is an inductive definition, of course, because a pair of values refers to values. So I can form tuples and do this inductively. And this is important here, for example. And where laziness helps me actually is this rule. If I consider this construction FP then P else Q, and I know that B evaluates to true and P evaluates to C, then the whole thing evaluates to C. This is lazy because I don't evaluate Q. If I evaluated the condition and it's true, then I immediately proceed to this branch and check it. And I don't care about this branch, it may diverge, but I will not notice it because I don't evaluate it. Then there is a rule for the case if B is false, then I only check Q and this is then symmetric. So the rules for lambda as in the lambda calculus. What is left? I mean, we always have this sort of rules, like P evaluates to C, and Q evaluates to C, C1, C2, and then the sum of course, this is the same symbol here, but this symbol, the plus, is this formal plus which we use to form expressions, and this plus is the plus over integers. So when I write the plus on the right-hand side, what I mean is I really add the integers, and this is the result. There are certain variants about how one can interpret the logical connectivities. Or let's consider this junction. So if we have, let's say, B evaluating to true, then we can say that B or C evaluates to true. This makes a certain sense because you can say if I evaluated a formula and you obtain truth, then you also need not evaluate the second formula because you may have divergence and you don't want it because you already have a truth condition. So you may say the semantics of my conjunction is such that truth is sufficient even if the partner component diverges. And you could do, I mean, the problem with it is either you need to assign the priority, so you need to distinguish between left and right, which is not very elegant because you expect that your disjunction must be symmetric, or you need to introduce rules like this. Okay, write true instead. And then say that B disjunction C is also true. But then the question is, who decides which component is taken? So you may start with the one component and get divergence. And if you get divergence, then how you start with the other one? So this sort of semantic presupposes that you have a non-deterministic machine which runs these two branches, and if one of them terminates, then you terminate and say that the result is true. So it's not always natural, and usually this sort of semantics is not considered, although theoretically it's a consistent semantics. And the one which is standard as So you evaluate one branch to true, and for the other branch, you just ensure that it terminates. And if it doesn't terminate, then the whole expression doesn't terminate. So then, the interesting rule is for the fixed points, and namely, if you want to say what the semantics of epsilon f is, so you calculate the semantics of epsilon so you substitute it in f and evaluate the result, and then this result is the result of the fixed point. This is a bit strange rule, and it's really the one which is the less natural, because it's not structural in the sense of the other rules. For all other rules, we have an expression which we reduce to its sub-expression. So we consider subterms, and we define the semantics of a program by means of the semantics of its subprograms. And here it's different. So the program here is more complex than the program there. So this still works, but it's an inelegant. It's not an elegant rule. But there is no other possible way to define it, because if you have divergence, I mean, if you want to have a possibility of divergence, you can form the rules in such a way that the premise is always simpler than the conclusion, because then you would terminate with all terms. So this is called by name, which is always simpler, and called by value, it differs from call by name in the respect in such a way that you would expect. So, for example, for the if constructor, I evaluate B, for example, to true, and I evaluate P to C and Q to D and then the whole result evaluates to C. But if I diverge on the right hand branch, then I will diverge in general. So there is a subtlety about the fixed point operator. Namely, if we consider big step semantics for SVM, what we have would be the transition like this. I said big step, small step. Called by name. And if you consider the same rule and the settings of call by value, you might notice a problem here. The problem here is if I accepted this rule, that would mean that, right, so I reduce this to this, and how I reduce this, I apply the rule for the application. Application tells me evaluate the function and then the argument. If I evaluate the argument, I use the same rule again and again and again. So, and the call by value settings, this is not a good rule because you would diverge everywhere. So instead of that, in call by value, we use, well, first thing is we define this operator, the fixed point operator, for the types which have a form of a function. So we cannot define this y returning an integer, for example. We just return a function which may you may apply to something, and then it would output an integer. And the second thing is the small step rule for it is like this. Just a moment. Yes. So this is like a dummy lambda abstraction. So if you apply the iter rule to this, if you were allowed to use the iter rule, you would immediately reduce it back to that. But we do not allow for the iter rule, and this is one of the reasons why iter rule is always often not considered to be part of the reduction semantics. So since I do not have an iter rule, I can form this lambda abstraction here, and it would not reduce. So it would guard my Redux. And the idea is this function f will take this term and apply it to something. So this Redux will eventually disappear, but it will disappear for a good reason, because f will do something. It will not disappear because of my semantics being flawed. Right. So that was basically a it concerning the operational semantics, I guess. This was like a recap, I don't know, or very quick primer into the operational semantics. So what I'm going to do next is, yes? Come again? So how do?
I don't understand the second semester rule there.
The second what?
The last
sentence.
The last sentence. Right?
The small step rule for why?
Yeah. And the rule below.
Yes.
How does it help me? I mean, I still can evaluate the y exponent.
No, you cannot, because in call by value there is an application here and there is a rule for application. So how you define your transitions? You always match the term with some rule. So to get this transition, you took the rule for y, and to reduce it further, you need to take the rule for the application. And the application tells me evaluate the function and evaluate the argument. So and the argument here is already a normal form. So it will not evaluate it anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is a good example, and that's why I'm showing you. I'm skimming through lots of material here and like showing you the most crucial places, and like do not touch lots of things. Because this sort of thing is like a really, really important feature. And what I'm going to do next is talk a bit about the denotational semantics. And I want to basically. I want to lead you to the idea of a notion of computation, which then is formalized as a monad. So we see from these two examples that we are talking about computations, and there are various ways to look at them. There's this call by value semantics, call by name semantics, there are more semantics, and there will be a whole bunch of different ways to consider computations in more general context, and we want to formalize this. We just want to set up a context for that, and one part of this context is the operational semantics, which we have considered to some extent, and the other side is the denotational semantics. And the denotational semantics require certain preliminaries. It's commonly considered to be like a more tough thing. It's not going to be so tough at the level we considered, but most of the people consider operational semantics to be something like a lightweight, because you just draw lots of rules and you immediately get an idea how it works. And denotational, if you're an engineer, you don't need to know too much math. And denotational semantics is more difficult in the sense you need more background. But why do we need the denotational semantics? Because we want to understand better what the meaning of a program is, because this does explain what the meaning of a program is, but it does it in a syntactic dependent way. Because I say I unfold the program and the result is the semantics of this program. But if I want to come up with a different programming language, I would come up with yet another semantics, and this notion will again be syntactic dependent, but I don't want the meanings of my program to be syntactic dependent, because I assume that I define things of a universal nature. So I want to have some domain for my values and for my programs, which is not syntactically syntactic dependent. And one immediate thought, which is wrong, is to come up with a set theoretic interpretation of these things. This works to a certain extent. We know that if you have a two sets, A and B, and you've got a correspondence given and, okay, then so in set theory, we form objects like this. We'll say that we form pairs A and B, and a set of pairs having certain properties, the functions. So we basically consider relations and say that a relation must be functional and I don't remember what the other property is called. It should be totally defined, and then we call such a thing a function. So we could just use it as a domain of types. We used to have naturals. Naturals is a set, and pairs is a set live in this domain. And then you could have exponentials, and you can say that this is the interpretation of my functional types. But you probably see why it wouldn't work, I guess, because precisely because we have divergence. So if you have a function which is total, yes.
What's the syntactic meaning of
A to B?
Yeah.
How it's defined?
Yes.
Well, A to B. Okay, it's I just described informally is the set of relations So this is a set of relation. It's clear what a relation is. It's a set of pairs. Yes?
Shouldn't A to the power of B be a subset of the power set of A plus B?
Yes. Thank you. So here, yes. And here, not. Because one relation is a subset, and a set of relations is a subset of the power set. Yeah. So an individual function is a relation which with certain properties. So what goes wrong here is I can start with naturals, for example. I can take naturals to naturals, but the functions which I define with lambda terms, with recursion, give me more than just natural. It gives me a natural, I mean, if I iterate a function from natural to natural, I can have a natural or a paradoxon. That's just, and I didn't have a slide. There would be a slide very good for illustrating this about from this nihilistic series where the two scientists send a pair of socks into the future as a Christmas pairs and then obtain a pair of socks and a paradoxon because of the time paradoxes. So that's a similar. If you send a natural throughout the loop, you do not have only a natural, but also a possibility of the divergence in addition to this. So you cannot just interpret functions as functions. There must be functions and a possibility that it diverges. So first candidate for the semantics of a type, well, let's say of a function type, would be just this function space which I've described. Now the other way around. Which doesn't work. The second candidate would probably be something like so my function is a function on the semantic level which sends, which outputs other values or may diverge. So this is still not good enough because that's what I have on the first iteration. I can have the divergence. I can now formalize my omega term here. So it will be the one which always just end up on this branch. But the problem is now I can use further syntactic constructions and apart from totally defined functions and totally undefined functions, I can have partially defined functions. So I may have something like f prime of x is equal to if x equal to bottom, then f prime of x else say g of x. Or no, if b say, then f of x and l's divergence like this. So I can verify an integer, a boolean, and then run a function or diverge. So this function is not completely defined, no completely undefined. It's something in the middle. It's partially defined because it's defined on some values. And okay, so probably would be good if it depends on the argument too. So it can diverge and it may not diverge. So once you include the divergence, the thing is the syntactic sugar, so the syntactic construction that you have, they generate lots of functions which are in between of definiteness and undefinedness. And this breaks down all this idea with using the sets. So the right idea is actually to use complete partial, so-called complete partial orders instead of sets. So these are structures which are better suited for semantics of the calculi we have, because we can talk about not only about things equal or not equal, but we can compare the things. Like if you have a defined function and a function which is just like the given one, but in its diverges on some values, then you can relate them. You can say that one function approximates the other. Do you have this notion defined in some of the courses, or it's completely new, complete partial orders? No, you don't? Okay. So then I will tell you what it is. So first we need partial orders. Partial orders are usually presented as pair, a set, and a comparison relation, and it's like a tradition in denotational semantics to use the symbol, not just smaller. So the axioms that we have are A is smaller than A, and A is smaller than B, and B is smaller than C, then A is smaller than C, and A smaller than B, and B smaller than A, hence they are equal. That's, I think, must be a part of some basic course. In addition to that, we require that we can form least upper bounds. So a CPO is a partial order such that for any chain A1, A2, so an infinite chain. There is A such that, so the first property is that for all I IE is smaller than A. And the second property, if there is another one, another element which has the same property, then this element must be bigger than A. So we have a chain, and we say that there is a least upper bound list because of this property, that if there is something else, then it's bigger than this least upper bound. And okay, and this is also part of this definition, and we denote so that's again a notation. So if we want to relate this A to this chain, then we use the symbol. So this is like a big union indexed by I. Understood? We also called a CPO pointed if it has a bottom element or the smallest element, so the one which is smaller than anything. And this makes, this, for example, would immediately rule out trivial examples of CPOs, because you can turn every set into a CPO. You just say that your approximation relation, so this is also called approximation relation. So you can say that this is just equality, and then every set is a CPO, trivially. But it's not necessarily a pointed CPO, because the pointed CPO insists that you have some ordering. So if you it postulates that there is the bottom element, so at least you need to compare something. And this general definition, it may just be completely trivial. So we will need pointed CPOs and not pointed CPOs. No, but you may not have this element. You can say, all right, you can turn a set into a pointed CPO by saying, this is my bottom element, and it's smaller than the rest. So, but turning a set into a CPO is not the same as viewing a set as a CPO, because you need to assign a bottom element, and there is a liberty to choose it, right? So you can say booleans is a CPU where I consider bottom smaller than the true, so false smaller than the true, and bottom is my false is my bottom. But I could just say that true is smaller than false, and that's another CPU. So yeah, you can turn it, turn a set into a bottom CPU, but not uniquely. And in terms of comparing to bottomless or not pointed CPUs, they are uniquely, there's a unique way to view it as a not pointed CPU, because you don't need to choose anything. No, no, you say that, no, sorry, what I said was define it as an equality, that's wrong. You define it as an empty relation. So you say, no, wait, I just write it down, trivial CPO, for which A approximates B if and only if A is equal to B. So I compare it in a trivial way. I just say that one is smaller than the other if they equal. And here, I would need to produce a bottom element because I postulate it. So I would need to tell what this is at least. So what the idea about it, why, how you should think of this, this is like, something like a domain for a data, and the approximation relation refers to a refinement of the data. So the smallest element is like you have got zero information, and then you can have more information, and this relation it relates to things from which one is bigger if it contains more information, and the one has less information. In the sense, it's less defined. Like that function that I gave here with if and boolean, it's less defined than the original function f, because in some argument I've diverged, but the original function f, it has more information because it diverged less. And the there's a notion associated to it, which is called a function is a continuous Okay, so I motivated the partial order, but I didn't motivate the least upper bound. So, but the thing is, when you start considering the partial orders, you need to consider chains because you've got recursion, and recursion produces sequences of values. And then you need to say what the upper bound of this chain, because the semantics of a program is like a limit of all its approximations. So when we calculate a semantics of a recursion operator, we need to go to the limit at some point. And this limit is this least upper bound. And then we have got a notion of continuous CPOs, which means that a function preserves this notion of the greatest bound. So like if I interpreted my semantics in such a way that it's a least upper bound of some chain, then a function is like preserves the semantics if it preserves this least upper bounds. So the candidate for these functions will be the constructions of my term. So the constructors for my terms like products. So if I defined components of a product as least upper bounds, I want that the semantics of the product is obtained by taking this least upper bounds and forming a pair, and this pair is itself a least upper bound. That's basically the structures which are only needed for defining the semantics of the language which we have defined. That's very much like set theory, where I don't know what if you had a set theory course, but you have like a way to construct sets. You say that you construct a set by constructing an empty set, then I add one element, and then I close everything under products, under power sets, etc. So here it's very analogous, because you just have a notion of which is a replacement of a notion of a set, and this notion is a CPO. And just as well, you can define constructions of a CPO in a similar way. For example, and this defined in the same way as we would define it for sets. But of course, since it's all CPOs and we want the result to be a CPO, we need to say how we define the order. And we define the order like this: A, B is, well, let's say 1, 1 is smaller than 2, 2. If A1 is smaller than A2, and B1 is smaller than B2. So there are lots of proofs behind this, which I'm not showing. I just hope that you would trust me that The thing that we define this way is actually CPO again. So we show how to define the order here, and it's more or less easy to define to prove that it's really a partial order. It's some slightly more difficult to prove that it's a CPO. So we would need to verify this property that this least upper bounds exists. And the properties so if you get like if you want to calculate the least upper bound of such chain, so I have got two indexes, and this is indexed. I use the first index for the first component of the pair, and the second for the second component. And then it's equal to a pair of least upper bound, so it distributes inside. And then other property is projections. Well, actually what this, I can just put it in brackets. So continuity I could call it continuity of pairing. And there's also continuity of projections. What this means, it means that PRI so if I want to take a projection of a least upper bound, it means that I need to project every single element and then calculate the least upper bound. So where I belongs to 1, 2, okay, what else one can do here? Another thing I can do is another construction is called lifting. It relates not pointed CPUs and pointed CPUs. So if I had like a CPU like this, I can transfer to another CPU by adding a bottom element. So this might have already another bottom element, but I add something below it. So this is going to be a new bottom. So it's a construction from A to A bottom. Where a bottom is equal to well, it's basically the union. I mean, it's a disjoint union because I mean, this A might already contain a symbol like this, and they would clash. And I want to say that this symbol is not the original one. If they coincide, we just rename them. And how we define the ordering? So A is smaller than B if so how I define the order, I just say if A is the bottom that I've adjoined, then it's smaller than any B. And otherwise, so if A is not the bottom that I've adjoined, then A is smaller than B if and only if both A and B came from the original CPU, and A is smaller than B in terms of the original CPU. It's just this diagram here, but written formally. So when I write this diagram, so we often depict the CPUs as a cloud. So we assume that there are like elements which are related, and the higher elements are greater than the smaller ones. And when I write a picture like this, it means that I add an element which is smaller than any of the previous ones. It would be convenient to use a notation, to formalize it as a function. So we write, let me just try write this arrow differently. I say here that I construct a CPU like this from a CPU like this. So it's not a function. It's a function between sets. But I also can define a function between sets. Let for any A in so for any A we defined. So it's like a like brackets, like this. But now I realize that it's not so easy to say what is meant here. I mean, it's just equal to A. I want to basically to indicate here that I changed the type. Yeah, I didn't want to go in this formalities. I mean, this is a...
I mean, I've seen that this criteria to be defined simply as the element and the type of the body set it belongs to.
Yeah, that's a bit. I need it only in this place and nowhere else. And we can define the disjoint union on sets. So because we only need to say have this X on sets, and on sets we may say that this is a union of what. Star. A in A, united with bottom star. So if you wanted to do it completely formally, then we could say that the disjoint union is like just a set formed like this. And then then I can just say that this is equal to this. So everything which I'm going to define is going to be continuous, of course. So this is an operation for constructing pointed CPOs from not necessarily pointed ones. And an immediate use of it is to define flat domains. And a flat domain is just obtained by taking a set which we view as a CPO, like I've described. So we just consider the ordering as equality. And we use this lifting to add the bottom element to make it into a pointed CPO. So this is the way how we form CPOs for data types like Booleans. So Boolean bottom is a CPO like this, true, false. So truth and false are not comparable because I pulled them from a set. And then I add bottom, which is smaller than any of them. And obviously, I can do it for all other data types that I have, like natural. And a non-example would be like this. So that would be like a domain which would correspond to that semantics for call by name of if operators, which I've sketched. So in the beginning, like if you want to check if a condition is true, you just check one of the branches, and if it's true, then you don't check the other one. And here, false is smaller than the true. And I don't adjoin the divergence. No, actually, I need the divergence, right? So I join the divergence. I've got true and false and bottom. But bottom is smaller than false, and false is smaller than true. So if I form a join like true or bottom, then I get true. So this true, it absorbs the bottom. Well, so true absorbs the bottom in both occasions, of course, but here true, it absorbs false and the bottom, and false absorbs the bottom. So yet another construction is yeah, right. So, okay, it is an example, actually, yes. But it's an example if you start with this as the input. Yeah. Yeah, I formulated it wrong. So it's not example of a flat domain, but it's an example of a lifting. Because flat domain means that you apply lifting to something which was originally, which has a trivial order originally. And here the order was not trivial. So there is a very interesting construction related to the liftings, and it's basically syntactic sugar. I didn't finish with the lifting. So for lifting, there is yet another operation. Let B be a pointed CPO, then and let F be continuous. So then we can define this is also called lifting this function, because we originally had a function from A to B, and we can lift it to a function from A bottom to B, because we proceed just by case distinction. We check if this argument came from A, then we just apply the original function, and it, if it came from the adjoined bottom, then we return bottom, but this bottom is the one from B. It's like, you extend the domain to which you're applying the function. And then there is a nice notation which we will need later. That's an error, yes. It's a double error. It's supposed to refer to the double error which you used for the big step semantics. And you can basically use some sort of intuition about the big step semantics, because what it says, evaluate P to X and then substitute it to Q and run Q. It's like it's a thing which we which mimics the rule for call by value application. So instead of just apply lambda q to p, we lift this lambda q using this construction and then apply the result to q, and it morally captures the semantics of the call-by-value rule, where you say if something evaluates to result, doesn't diverge, I use this result, substitute it, and run it in the in my other program. Well, actually, it's not only call-by-value, it's also in call-by-name, because in both occasions you evaluate the only in call by value, because only in call by value you evaluate the argument. So you evaluate the argument and then you substitute and then evaluate the rest. So it's like a bridge to the operational semantics. Okay, I think probably we finished just 2 minutes before, because there is yet another thing, the last construction that I wanted to present, but it would take more than 2 minutes. Okay, I wanted to say that in principle we have exercises, and I'm getting at it. So I will try to publish today or tomorrow an exercise sheet. It's supposed to last for 2 weeks. So the plan is eventually we start interchanging the lectures and practice, so, and do the practice on Wednesday. So, but if I publish it now, then you will have 2 more weeks until the deadline, then you give it back, and then on practicals we will discuss them, and I hope that someone will present it. But there is still this 2 weeks gap, so I will publish it on the webpage of this course on our webpage. Yeah, and so the evaluation of this course will be like half of the note will be the exam and half of the note will be the exercise. So the exercises will be quite important. All right, this is it.